Welcome to Get in the Herd, a podcast about addiction and recovery brought to you by the McShin Foundation. If you or a loved one are looking for real discussions about addiction, recovery, stigma, advocacy, and most importantly, hope, then stick around. Thanks for joining us. Now sit back and get ready for another great episode of Get in the Herd.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the award-winning recovery podcast, Get in the Herd, brought to you by the McShin Foundation. I'm your host today, Nathan Mitchell, and today with us in the studio is somebody I met first in September last year, and man, does he electrify a room. He is a Boston police officer, and what I love about that is, you know, for me as a person in recovery, I didn't always get along with people in uniforms for the longest times, and so to have somebody on the side, you know, wearing a uniform, be a part of recovery, and or at least be a part of facilitating recovery for so many people, and to share a message of hope and humanize the experience for us as people in recovery, humanize what it means to be an officer, you know, is really powerful. So today with us, we have Joshua De La Rosa, and he is heavily featured in the, what do we call this? It's now nominated for several awards, Tipping the Pain Scale. I forgot to grab a list of that, but I saw a whole bunch of award nominations for this movie, Tipping the Pain Scale by Greg Williams and other people who did the anonymous people a few years ago. So today we have Joshua. Joshua, welcome to the show, my friend. You are just amazing. Great to have you here, man. What's going on with you in Boston?
Thank you for having me. A lot of things are going on in Boston, but as you would, we had a brief conversation earlier. I was speaking a little bit about boxing and some of the stuff I'm doing with the youth, and I was actually telling you that a couple of years back, pre-COVID, maybe a couple of months before COVID, my partner and I, we were planning on using boxing to get folks into recovery. So it was a program we were getting ready to start. It was called Boxing Recovery. The Phoenix Gym was going to allow us to use their facility. On top of that, I wanted to get back into fighting. I was actually training to fight. My partner is actually a boxing promoter and a manager, and he was going to set me up with a few fights. The whole purpose of it was to raise money for folks to be able to get into sober houses. One of the major things that we see here in Massachusetts is that some of the drug treatment programs are not long enough for folks that are suffering from the opiate crisis. So you get folks that are going to a 7-day detox. From there, they might have like a 13 to 15 days at a clinical stabilization service. And then from there, they'll put them in the halfway house, and the halfway house will probably be a couple of months, 2 or 3 months. So at most, they'll probably get 6 months worth of treatment. And some of these treatment facilities don't really allow them to go out and work, or some of the jobs can't really cater to their schedule, or rather their schedule doesn't cater to some of these jobs. So it's hard for somebody to get out of these treatment programs and continue with their recovery, because they don't have money to be able to pay for a sober house, and that's like the biggest things with sober houses. They cost a lot of money in the city of Boston, not just the city of Boston, but all over the state of Massachusetts. So like anybody that's battling with recovery, your dopamines are not all there. And when you get frustrated, sometimes you just want to look for that escape. And that was one of the biggest things I was struggling with getting folks into treatment. It was beautiful to see somebody 6 months in, 7 months in, 8 months in, but now they find themselves outside on the streets with nowhere to go. And all the, the majority of the shelters that we have here in the city of Boston, all right next to areas where there's open drug dealing and not just open drug dealing, but there's multitudes of people using drugs. So for somebody that's fighting for their recovery, it's like, I use an example. It's like somebody that's on a diet. They say, hey, and a friend taught me this one time. He said, you have to look at it from this point of view. He says, listen, Josh, you just entered a diet. You walk down the street and somebody's offering you your favorite meals. They're offering you chocolate cake. They're offering you cookies. They're offering you peanut butter cups. They're offering you all these types of candies. And how hard is it for you to say no? You walk to the next block and it's like, no. So he's like, it's the same thing. You're walking down some of these streets and you're in recovery and they say, hey, I got Johnny's. I got rocks. I got this. I got that. It's so hard for you to not fall in, not to give in to that temptation. So it's like most of the folks that are suffering from substance abuse are being set up for failure. And that's one of the things that I was fighting hard for a couple years back. Now that COVID is kind of fading away, we're probably, my partner and I, we're going to jump right back on it and try to see what we can do to better serve some of the folks in our community.
I saw the picture of you, pictures of you with children and kind of in a little boxing, a picture of you in a boxing stance. And I see that. I mean, I've met you in person. You're a tall guy with a long reach. So I guess you're a pretty formidable foe. You're also a Boston police officer.
Yes.
And so, that's a big part, of to me, that's a big, wow, here's an officer of the law and who actually starts to see what recovery can be and what addiction really is, and taking that criminal element out of it. What got you into the community outreach that you do? And for the people who aren't listening or who don't know you and are listening, What I mean is, if to know Joshua, to see what you've done through the movie, you see that you participated in this homeless shelter, which is primarily populated with individuals with a substance use disorder or mental health complications, or really a lot of the same, both. And seeing you going in there and seeing you go in there in uniform, and they talk about that in the movie and talk about you going in there and just really trying to be a force for good in there and providing maybe some resources, but also, man, I think what's really cool about you is just going in there and giving people haircuts. It's the, that human experience. I'm a person, I have this skill set, I can help you with this. I may not know how to get you off drugs. I may not be able to get you a house today, but I can sit here and spend some time with you, listen to you, and give you a haircut. What got you into that?
So I always tell people that in this world, everyone has a worldview. We all have, I believe sociology calls it social constructionism, social constructs. When we build our background, so the way we perceive the world, there's actually a quote that says, we don't see the world how the world is, but we see the world how we are. Mm. And I believe, so my worldview comes from a Christian worldview. I'm also on the side. So by day I'm a police officer, and by night I do ministry, and I'm a Christian pastor, and I just love people. And hating people or disliking people is not an option in my worldview. There's nowhere in the Bible that teaches you to hate people, and so when I see an individual in front of me, they can be whoever they are, and my job is to love that person. I've had, and we'll get back to the recovery, but I've had situations where, like, let's say somebody just finished assaulting somebody, and now I'm involved in a foot chase, and we're wrestling, we're struggling, and they're fighting me, we're fighting back. Even though they're hitting me, they're kicking me, they're punching me, I can still, through my worldview, still love this person, even if I ended up handcuffing them. Right after that, I'll say, hey, I'll shake hands. Listen, don't take it personal, man. This is just my job. I want you to know that I'm just like I had a response to this incident. I'm also available to help you. So this is my name. This is my information. Whenever you want to reach out, you can always stop by this police station, and I'm also here to help you. If you want to change the way you live, change the way your lifestyle is, I'm here to help. Whatever I can help, whatever resources I can reach out to get in contact with to better facilitate them for you, let me know and I'll help you. Now, with the recovery, when I first tried to do ministry, my first time ever doing ministry was going out to do outreach. I remember this was back in 2009. I must have been about, I think I was about 19 to 20 years of age. I went out to the streets to evangelize. And the first population that I came across was a population of those that were in active substance abuse. And I had this heart for folks that were suffering from substance abuse. Like it was immediately there. Most of the people that I was out there trying to minister to, they would stop by and listen to me and have a conversation with me. And I gained a heart for them. And I remember years ago, some people don't really believe in something that's called like the prophetic, or when people prophesy over your life, I believe that in some societies they call it manifesting or speaking certain words over your life. And I remember this, I visited this church one time, and this guy doesn't know me from a hole in the wall. This guy points me out and he says, I see you working a lot with folks that are trying to get in, that are trying to leave drugs. He didn't understand what he was seeing. So he's having like this vision in his head. He's saying, I see you working with people that are trying to get out of drugs in the future. And I see God using you powerfully in that area. And it's so funny because that same week, this guy that I met was inviting me to speak at sober houses on Wednesdays, out in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I was thinking about, should I do it or not? Because it was an hour and 15 minutes to drive out there every day. An hour and 15 minutes to drive over there, and then an hour and 15 minutes to drive back. So that's 2.5 hours gone. It's a lot to do that every Wednesday. But, I said to God, I need a sign. If you want me to go out there, I need a sign. So then this weekend, this guy says that to me, and I decided, you know what? I have to make it. And every Wednesday, I would struggle to go out there. But every time I went out there, it was overwhelming. Like that good feeling you would get when folks that were getting ready to, let's say, go back to using drugs would come up to you and say, listen, I was getting ready to quit. Some would tell me I was getting ready to take my life tonight. And the fact that you came here to speak to me and just provide those words of encouragement and push me, you just changed the way I'm thinking right now. And to me, that was a huge blessing. That was amazing, and I still do it. Anybody I come across that I know needs help or that's soliciting my help, I'm there to help you.
That's awesome, man. Mm-hmm. The work that you do at the community center that is shown in the movie, you know, and you going in there in the uniform, because, well, first of all, I love that you're a pastor and a police officer. What a combination. What an opportunity to really do good in areas in a lot of ways. So, you know, the work that you do, you know, we could call it ministry, you know, with the community outreach that you're doing. You talked a little bit in the movie, or it was discussed in the movie a little bit, how that was the uniform initially was a barrier to trust. Yeah. How have you seen the transformation of trust, not only with you in uniform and the individuals you serve, but with you in uniform and other individuals in uniform. So how have you seen a transformation with the other officers you work with in how they also respond to situations which are, which you know, have a substance use element in them?
So I think it really helped to break that barrier with the community that's an active addiction and a police officer. There was a huge barrier. Again, I testified in the past in the movie. I stated that the police department wanted me to get out there and basically do outreach, try to convince individuals to go into treatment. But nobody wanted to talk to a police officer in uniform. It was like if you did that, you're a snitch. And the drug, so like in the area of Mass and Cass, the drug dealers are out there. They're watching every single movement. Yeah. They're watching if you're going up to have a conversation with a police officer. So everyone that was in that area was afraid to speak to a police officer. Either they were afraid, and from my prior experience when I worked in the jail, a lot of the inmates that I had, they enjoyed having conversations with the correction officer. They enjoyed it. They would have open conversations in front of everybody so everybody can hear what they're saying, and so nobody will call them a snitch. So I know that folks out in the streets, they want to speak to you, but they're like, so-and-so, the drug dealer, might think that I'm actually telling on him. So, and it's sad because they'd probably catch a beating if that was the case.
Yeah.
So I when I went out there, I'm like, how can I do away with this uniform? I couldn't. The department wouldn't allow me to. They say, nope, it's dangerous. So I'm all right. So I carry this thing where it says, what would Jesus do? I said, okay, well, what did Jesus do when there was a barrier between him and the Samaritans? He wanted to go do outreach to the Samaritan people, and the Samaritan people didn't want to receive him. So what did he do? He used one of his spiritual gifts to get in contact with the Samaritan woman. And when he was able to connect with that Samaritan woman testified about him. That Samaritan woman said, hey, come and see a great man that told me everything about my life, you know? And that's pretty much how it happened. I was like, you know, well, what can I do? Let me grab I know how to cut hair. I know that everybody that I'm looking at right now needs a haircut. So so I spoke with the manager of the engagement center. He allowed me to go in there, and I started giving out haircuts. At first, everybody's like, what the hell's going on? I'm not getting a haircut. until I hooked one guy up with a really nice fade. They saw that nice fade, and then word started to spread. And I went from having 2 or 3 people in line to having a line of 30, 40, 50 people. I had to start bringing other barbers to come help me. And then the word just started to spread. Even the drug dealers got the message that I wasn't out there for enforcement purposes. Yes, I was a police officer. Yes, I'm a police officer, but I'm not out there for enforcement purposes. Were there situations where you needed enforcement? Absolutely. Especially like if there was a rape case. There was a rape case, like stuff like that. I immediately have to step in. But the drug dealers knew, listen, I'm out here specifically to get other folks into treatment. I can't say the rest about the drug unit that's out there. I can't say the rest right. about the gang unit. I can't say the rest about all the other officers. But specifically, my assignment is to get folks into recovery. That's my assignment. And the drug dealers, it was to the point where the drug dealers would bring me certain folks that were really bad with their addiction. And they would say, listen, you got to get this person out of here. They would bring the person, because the drug dealers had that much respect and that much power over the people, that they would walk up to me and say, hey, you got to get this person out of here. They need help.
On a side note, on from a personal experience, usually when I got to that point with a dealer, it was because I ended up owing them a lot of money. But but that's me and my story and my using, and thank God I'm not doing that today.
Yeah.
Something we do here in Richmond that's actually just started a program called it's called Project Recover. I think recovery is an acronym there, and I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but it includes a ride along component with with police officers for those first responders, with peers in recovery. Do you all do that in Boston? Do you ever have any, you know, peers in recovery who, you know, have maybe some specific peer training work with you and try to connect as well?
Absolutely, we do. We have recovery coaches.
Okay.
That they ride with us. In the city of Boston, we only had 4.
Wow.
2 of them ended up relapsing because it's so hard. It's so hard for you to do this day and night. And I would always pull them to the side and say, hey, listen, make sure you're taking time off. Make sure you shut your phone off at a certain hour because it's going to get to you at a point. And they're like, no, we can do it. We can do it. And then, sure enough, it ended up happening. So the third one, she used to be a prostitute. She used to work the streets. She had a heavy crack addiction, and now she's like an amazing person, but she's out there. She works for another agency now, but whenever I call and I say, hey, I need you out here, she'll jump in the cruiser. She'll do it for free. She doesn't even care. She'll go out there with me and we'll talk to a female that's like working the streets. And then there's the fourth person. She's actually working in the prison now, but we can still work together even if she's still working in the prison. She's another person that she'll go above and beyond, and she'll do it not even getting paid, just because she loves, she's in recovery and she loves helping people get into recovery. She doesn't do it for the money. Now, what the police department did, the street outreach unit did, was train folks and make them certified recovery coaches. So like if we couldn't get somebody to ride with us, because we do have clinicians that ride with us as well, that also have a lot of training in mental health and also drug and alcohol, substance abuse. So they have, I forget the actual term for it, but they have plenty of training with that. So if ever we need to have one of them jump in with us, they're more than willing to do it. But also a lot of us are trained in all certified recovery coaches.
Yeah, that's wonderful. There was a case here, Richmond, you know, I live in Henrico County, which is right outside of Richmond City. And well, actually, I live in Richmond City. I'm working in Henrico County right outside of Richmond City. And there was a case here in Henrico County when I was in early recovery a few years ago. And it really resonated with me. Officers responded to a wellness call. A woman who was in her own home having some kind of mental health breakdown. And during the course of the officers responding, they entered the home. They found her barricaded in her bedroom and they opened the door. I guess they broke down the door. And her response was, you know, she came at them with an axe and they shot her and she died. And, you know, that I know there are stories like that all around the country.
Yes.
And so, you know, obviously we've been very vocal about trying to get more crisis stabilization units and more crisis, you know, response, you know, training for first responders. But I know that's still a thing. And you know, somebody with a mental health crisis or substance use related emergency, you know, is certainly not going to be acting in the best, you know, their best selves. And we find that time and time again. I don't know what the laws are in Massachusetts. We've been going back and forth here in Virginia about Good Samaritan laws. So essentially, yeah. So you're probably familiar. I'm sure you have a similar law in Virginia now. If you're experiencing a substance use related emergency and a person makes a phone call, the person making the call, the person who is ODing or has the emergency, and it turns out the person who is helping in that case too. So if you're administering naloxone or whatever, you are immune from prosecution. And that law actually is just, we think going to change a little bit, enhance a little bit because the way that it's worded right now that they've been issuing show causes and violating people on probation around here with that. So that might change again so that they don't, but how is that in Massachusetts? Sorry.
We have the same. We actually have the same exact law. Yeah. And people are not getting violated though, unless probation really wants that person. So we actually have the same exact law, and it's funny the term actually comes from the Bible.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's basically Jesus teaching people, listen, your neighbor is anybody that's in need. That's your neighbor. Not somebody that looks like you, not somebody that comes from the same background as you. It's anybody who's in need and needs help. That is your neighbor. So the Good Samaritan law, we actually have the same. I'm actually proud of what Boston Police has been doing with responding to a mental health crisis. I was with the street outreach unit at the time that we were creating the model for it. So what we do is whenever we get like let's say we call it a Section 12, which is a involuntary commitment for a mental health evaluation. We were having a lot of situations where officers were responding to calls and the individual barricade themselves, like in the case that you just finished stating. So that was happening a lot. So now the protocol is that if one of these requests comes down to one of the police stations or to Boston EMS, we have a team of officers and clinicians that vet the person. They screen the person really well. They check their backgrounds. They check all the reports. They check all their medical psych history. And they all make a decision whether this person is an elevated risk to barricade themselves or they're dangerous enough to attack an officer. And if that's the case, then you make a better approach. You're going to respond with a clinician. You're going to respond with officers, a street outreach officer that has a dress down uniform. And it's really good at working with people and speaking with people. And on the street outreach unit, we have a couple of officers that were clinicians and were EMTs, were paramedics.
Yeah. Are you there? Oh, Josh, I think we lost. Oh, there you are. Are you there, Josh? Joshua?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry, somebody called me. I tried to put it on Do Not Disturb.
That's all right.
Let me try it one more time. Give me a sec.
Well, hey, Joshua, I'll tell you what. This might be a good time for us to take a 90-second break and put a commercial in real quick. And we'll be right back with our awesome special guest, Boston Police Officer / pugilist / minister. I know, I love that word, right? / community outreach guru, Joshua De La Rosa over here. When you get back, we'll talk about your background and we'll talk about what your future, if you're interested. So we'll be right back. Thanks, buddy.
Definitely.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back. Our special guest today is Joshua De La Rosa. Joshua De La Rosa, as I was describing earlier, I love the word pugilist. So I'm going to describe you as a Boston police officer, a pugilist, a community outreach guru, and a good old roundabout, and a minister. I'm sorry, a pastor. You know, I think that's a really amazing kind of what. When do you have time for anything else?
This is some of the stuff. I'm also a full-time student, so some of the stuff.
Wait a second. Hold on a second. You're a full-time student. You're a full-time police officer. You teach boxing. Are you married? Do you have a girlfriend?
I'm married. I'm going on number four.
You're on a fourth child. You're what, 25?
No, I'm 33.
You're 33. Well, you look a lot younger. All right. Well, 33 going up. Good for you, man. That's exciting. What are you studying? Sorry. What are you studying in school?
Oh, so I'm in school. I'm actually in two schools, but I'm not taking more than four classes at a time. So I'm wrapping up with criminal justice, and I'm also in school for biblical studies. Trying to work on my bachelor's in biblical studies. It's a divinity degree.
Wow. So I asked you and cut you off. What do you do in your free time, or how do you have any free time?
It's so hard for me to have free time. The only free time I have is either very late night or early 4 in the morning. So it's how I go to sleep at 2 or wake up at 4 in the morning. I try to, when I hit the age of 30, I realized I had like a midlife crisis.
I'm laughing because I'm 46, but okay.
But I was super sad at the age of 30. And I said, yeah. Oh my God, just the other day I was 18. What am I doing? And I realized that how valuable time was. And I said, you know what? I can't waste time. One thing is that I value time. I love time. So I'm always, I try to plan out my day. I try to plan out my week, even though it never goes according to plan, because something always pops up. Some issue always pops up. Even like tonight, I have to sit down with a couple that they're struggling in their marriage, and my wife and I have to sit down with them and just give them some marriage counseling tips, and that's pretty much how my life is. I really don't have time for anything, but I have to prioritize. I learned something a long time ago, and it's from the preacher named T.D. Jakes. He said something along the lines that we are limited human beings. He said, we are limited human beings. And what that means is that we're always going to fail somebody. We're either going to fail our kids. We're either going to fail our spouses. We're either going to fail our bosses. We're going to fail our friends. We're going to fail our coworkers. We're going to fail somebody throughout the week. He said, just try not to fail the same person all the time. He said, and that's just the result of us being human beings. We are limited. We are limited. We can't be everywhere at the same time. So we're always going to fail somebody.
Well, Mayor De La Rosa, I'm sorry, Officer De La Rosa, what plans do you have going forward in the future for yourself?
I want to grow in ministry. And I do want to grow in the police department. I don't know if one day the department or God allows for me to get promoted and make it to the top somewhere, or as a bureau chief and be able to manage a certain department within the police department. But those are my plans for now. I go wherever God wants to lead me. For now, what's in front of me is ministry at night and ministry during the day, because I consider my job ministry.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I love I love that you go and do the haircuts. I keep going back to that. When I think of you, I think of that. It's a very humanizing thing. You know, I this is one thing I know everybody needs. And you know, so my story, I am alumnus of the McShin Foundation. I came through here. I started through one of our jail programs, and then came to about 2 hours away towards DC, and came here to Richmond, moved into our housing. And actually, my first house leader is the producer of the podcast sitting right over here. So we're still friends 4 years later, which is really awesome. You know, Justin and I, yeah, we've known each other that long. And so literally since day one for me here in Richmond, and to go on that journey, and you know, we've gone separate ways and come back at some point too. But through this process, you know, what I've learned, because now I've moved out of our recovery housing here, I stayed in Richmond and I work for the McShin Foundation, and you know, I'm doing adult things and not getting in trouble, and I'm off probation now, and all these, you know, things are happening. And what I've learned, though, is one of the best things that I can do to help the next person coming in the door is really just to sit and either sit, listen. Sometimes even that's not enough. It's like sometimes that's just not what's necessary. Sometimes it's just sharing a meal. And it's kind of the same thing as, you know, everybody needs to get a haircut. Everybody needs to eat. You know, there are certain things that every person needs. And, you know, sometimes the best way for me to connect is just sharing that basic connection with them. And I can do that. I can always do that. When I don't know what to do, I can always feed somebody. And that's what I've learned here, as I've gotten bigger too. but you know, I, and by the way, I need a haircut.
Yeah. Tomorrow, I'll take a trip out there and give you a haircut. Bring my tool.
Well, you know, so yeah, You can do that. Would be cool. Or I'd like to take. I love Boston. I haven't been to Boston. I'm 40. I'll be 46 this year. And I think the last time I was in Boston, I was 20 or 21. That's not true. I drove through Boston a few years ago. We stopped for lunch with a friend, but to actually be in Boston, and I had a friend who was at Harvard, and we stayed in, you know, blah blah blah. It was it felt very fancy at the time, but you know, we were in but I got into Boston University, so I had this whole mindset that Boston was going to be the place where I developed roots, and for me that wasn't the story, which I've had great stories since. I mean, I continue to find new things to be grateful for. But I love Boston is what I'm getting at. I need to come up and visit. That's where I'm going with that. It's a great city. We have here at the McShin Foundation, we're a nonprofit organization, and we have our recovery community organization. We have 14, soon to be 14 recovery residences here in the area, about 150 beds when we get the new house. And one of the things that we've brought in, you know, we've been around for almost 18 years now. One thing we brought in, well, one thing that's always been here is a connection with spirituality, you know, and whatever that means to the individual. It's not a religious thing necessarily. It's a spirituality thing. Mm-hmm. And recently, what, a year and a half ago, Justin, we brought in a pastor, and he in addition to doing a jail program that we have in Richmond City, which is wonderful. He does our spiritual service on Sundays. It's a non-denominational spiritual service that he does. And we broadcast it live on Facebook, just like we're doing now. And it has really brought together so much of the community to really heal from COVID. You know, he has.
I think I met him.
You met Walt?
Yeah, I did. I did meet Walter. Yeah.
Oh, he's electric, isn't he?
Yeah. He's a great. I sat in his office and I had a nice conversation with him.
Testify Tuesday. He does. Yeah. He has a third Tuesday. He has the show and he does. Okay. Yeah. Oh, so you've met Walt. Okay, that's cool. Man, I don't know how sometime, but I think your ministry, we might try to figure out how we can get your ministry on Sunday morning. If I'll let you and Walt talk about that. But
well, our services, they run at Sunday night at 5:30.
Okay. Well, maybe we need to get our participant. Do you guys do it Facebook Live or anything like that?
Not yet. We bought all the equipment. Now we're trying to get somebody to get trained in it.
Okay.
So we're waiting to see if we can get some of the kids to learn. Maybe I can send them out to you guys and you guys can teach them how to.
Justin, run. I see job opportunities for you, buddy.
I was about to say, if you're willing to cover the cost of a relocation to Boston, then.
if you'd like to come out one day just to give them a training, we'll cover the cost.
I'd be more than happy to do that, actually.
There you go. That'll look at this connections. What's that?
That'll actually be huge. We'll cover the hotel and expenses, travel expenses.
We'll talk for sure.
Absolutely.
That would be cool. All right. Well, look, connections right here. My friend, I love having you here as a guest. I love talking to you, and I always feel very calm in your presence, you know, and I've been in your presence, I guess, twice really, but once where I was really in your presence, when you were sitting in front of me at the Macklemore concert. you may not remember that, but I certainly do.
I do. And, I got the photo.
We probably have a lot of fun. That was a blast though, wasn't it? That was a great concert. That man's got some energy. Everybody had energy. That one woman who did the Tina Turner song, I forget what her name was, but she had crazy energy, but yeah. What kind of stuff, man? So talking about the future, I just called you mayor. Are you still connected with Mayor Walsh or now I guess Secretary Walsh?
No.
You talk to him?
Only when I run into him and he always tells me, hey, listen, call me. If you need anything, call me. But I really don't like to bother somebody who's too busy. He's got bigger fish to fry. But I know that he's always there if I ever need to ask him for anything. Because he always tells me, if you ever need anything, give me a call. But he is a great man. He still lives in Dorchester. when he's in town, you know, he's a great man. He's a All right, he's a great man, great person. He's the reason why my wife's a police officer today. He helped my wife get onto the police department. So I have nothing but good things to say about him. He's a great man. But this city does need a lot of help. We need a lot of recovery from that COVID crisis, and just a lot of emotional support, and not just with adults, but a lot of the kids are suffering from it. And I didn't realize how bad it was because I was always working. I never stopped working. But all the studies that are coming out now and just having some conversations with people, I was like, wow, I didn't realize how much the isolation affected people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can say the same thing. I never stopped working either. And, you know, the difference is that a lot of the outreach stuff that I did in person went to Zoom. And that has its own isolating effects. And I'm getting the same things. You know, my sister and my brother-in-law, they've spent a lot of time inside with their young kids, and I know it's having an effect on them, and it's a struggle. I'm glad we're getting out of this. So are you from Boston originally?
Yes.
You grew up in Boston?
Yeah, born and raised in Boston. I am my family from the Dominican Republic.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. So my mom, it's crazy because sometimes I get asked about the border situation, and my father, he crossed the border, met my mom here. they made babies.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I have like conflicted views on the whole border crisis. You know, they're like, oh, should we? Listen, I'm stuck in between. So I came out of an open border, so I can't really comment on that one.
Yeah, well, I was gonna go towards food because that's where my mind always goes, and I'm like, all right, cool, some good Latin food. So tell me, man, is your mom a good cook?
Oh, my mom, you know, I can't. Everybody says our mothers are the great cooks, but I hear from everywhere. Everywhere. My mom cooks a lot of times and brings food on Sunday to church, and people tear it up. She's like, and she just loves cooking.
Yeah.
You're in town, she will make you, you'll get bigger than what you are. Not saying that you're big, but she will feed you. She will feed you, man.
Yeah. Is your wife a good cook too?
I cook. I am. That was
you
actually
cook. Okay.
What I was doing before I got into law enforcement. I was doing culinary arts.
That's a big shift.
Huge.
going from carrying a knife to carrying a gun. So tell me, man. And this, believe me, I've worked in kitchens for a long time. The chefs can be pretty vicious with those knives. What brought you what made you change course there?
So, I grew up in a really, really bad neighborhood. There was all you saw around us was gangs. Drug dealing, like in the movie, I testified that most of my family members were involved in the drug game, especially my father. He got deported for selling drugs. My uncles, my cousins, everybody sold drugs. One of my cousins was actually the leader of one of the blood sets. I don't know if you're familiar with the Bloods and the Crips, but he was one of the leader of one of the blood sets in East Boston, and I was kind of copying what he was doing, but the neighborhood that I grew up in had different gangs, so I was becoming a product of my environment. I started at a young age, started stealing. I'm not afraid to testify about it now because this is like 18 years ago, and I've been in law enforcement for 15 years now. But I also got involved into selling drugs as well as a kid when I was 16. I couldn't sell like crack cocaine or any of the heroin because that was like a territory thing where some of the older guys, they would kill you if they caught you selling crack. So I was only able to sell marijuana, and if anybody was asking for rocks, I would just bring them over to one of the older guys. So I just facilitated those type of deals, or I would, it's still drug dealing. If I grabbed the money and I went to go grab the crack and distribute it, that was still considered, that's still considered under Mass General Laws as drug dealing. So I was becoming a product of my environment, hands down. I was supposed to get into, I was supposed to get jumped into a gang one weekend, and I got invited. You know, well, before I get into this, that's how I learned how to cut hair. I learned how to cut hair and braid hair because my plans one day was I was going to do life in prison. Or I was going to serve prison time, and I needed all my friends that were going in and out of jail. He said, this is a good way to make canteen money for cutting hair. One of my cousins, that's how he made his money. He either braided hair or he was giving guys lineups in jail. And he said, you can make some great money like that. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to learn how to cut hair because one day I might have to do prison time. And I grew up, we grew up poor. My brother and I, we grew up poor. We grew up in poverty. So we had to find ways to get whatever we wanted. Now at the age of 16, I'm supposed to get jumped into a gang on a weekend. On a Wednesday, there was this girl that invited me. She was a really good friend of mine. She invited me to a youth group. It was like a Christian youth group. I went over, and the guys, he's speaking about the story of Elijah and Elisha in the Bible, and he's saying that that Elisha had to cross over a river to receive the double portion of Elijah's spirit, you know. So he starts going around the room saying, what's the river in front of you that's stopping you from crossing over to receive your blessing? So he's going around the room and he gets to me and I don't know what he's talking about. First of all, I'm thinking when he's saying blessings that, you know, a changed lifestyle, that's what I'm thinking in my head. So when he says, what's my river? I didn't have an answer. He said, you know what? Just think about it. Think about it. And I can ask you next week. The pastor was there and he invited me to church and I didn't want to go to that church. Because I was, I grew up Catholic, and the one time I visited a non-denominational Christian church, back in the days, it was such a long service. It was like three or four or five hours, and I remember being so hungry as a kid that day when I visited that service. I can never do this. And I grew up Catholic, and I'm used to a one-hour mass. You know,
in and out. You're done. Yeah, so and then time for brunch.
Yeah. He said, you should come over. And I said, I don't think I can. So I'm giving him an excuse because I'm going back to that traumatizing experience of 4 or 5 hours of service. And I said, I don't think I can because I'm Catholic. And he says to me, listen, son, God's doors are open for everybody. So that weekend, I actually postponed my gang initiation for the following weekend. But that weekend, my life changed. Drastically, completely. I went dressed as a gang member with my bandana hanging out. I went in there and the pastor, he preaches this powerful sermon, and he asked me at the end of the sermon, do I want to give my life to Christ? Do I want to accept Christ as my Lord and Savior? And I had so much hate and anger in my heart. Like I was one of those kids that would always black out. I had episodes where I would black out, break walls, break anything. I was very rebellious. I didn't listen to my mom. I'm not afraid to admit, when I was young, I would even hit my mom. I was a really messed up kid. I had a lot of anger issues. And what was happening was that when my father got deported, my mom started dating different men. These different men would beat the living lights out of her. Not just her, but they would beat my brother and I. It was really, really bad. There was times where, like, I'll never forget, you know, I'm free from all my trauma, but I'll never forget all the stuff that happened to us as kids, where, like, this one guy in the winter, cold water, put my brother and I in a bathtub, water running, and started whipping us. Like we're animals, you know, he's whipping us. Sometimes we get locked in a room and for days, and we were only allowed to use the bathroom, and we were being fed like we're animals. So I went through a lot of traumatic experiences as a kid, and that's just to name a few. But I had so much hate and anger that the last boyfriend that my mom had, She was with him for a while. But this guy, he was like the worst of the worst. Even though I did learn a lot of good things from him, but he was also very, very violent. And one time when I was 14, I found his firearm in the closet. I was looking for a camera. This camera that I saw one time that my mother had, and I'm looking for the camera. Nobody was in the house, and I end up finding the gun. And I held that gun and I said, you know what, when he comes in, I'm going to shoot this guy. And I decided, you know what, there was like, I felt like something telling me, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. But I was planning already, you know what, I'm going to shoot this guy. And I was planning not, but that voice was saying, don't do it, don't do it. So I didn't do it. At that time, again, my life is, I'm all messed up. I'm becoming a product of my environment. At 14, I was already getting drunk. I already knew what it was to drink. I didn't get like stupid wasted, but I would drink, sexually active, smoking marijuana, getting high. This is 14, so I'm all messed up. At 16, I have this encounter where once this guy tells me to pray this prayer, the sinner's prayer, and he's praying over me, I just couldn't. I felt like I was being set free from every pain, from every hurt, from everything that went on in my life. And I remember that I walked a mile home and I was just crying the whole way. And it was like tears of joy. Like whenever you're being set free from something, I was just crying. I couldn't stop crying. And I started calling everybody that I hated. I said, I forgive you. Nobody taught me on forgiveness, but I just started calling everybody to say, listen, you know, I forgive you. I forgive you. I even called my mother's boyfriend. I said, listen, you know, I forgive you. At the age of 12, turning into 13, you know, this is prior to that, is when I really got into boxing. And I got into boxing because I was going to beat him up.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Wow. Oh, wait. Are you there?
Am I here?
I hear you now. I hear you.
Okay. So I got into boxing because I wanted to beat this guy up, and then I became really good at boxing, and I enjoyed it. I gave my life to Christ at 16, and my life changed, and I had to play catch up, where I wasn't doing too good in school, because all my life all I did was skip school, so I ended up. Even though I'm changing my life, I ended up dropping out just because I couldn't catch up. I was very illiterate. And I remember that I was working in a deli, and this police officer comes in, and I asked him a question. I said, hey, is it hard to become a police officer? And at that time, I've worked in restaurants. I had multiple jobs. I'm working full time. And I asked him, is it hard to become a police officer? He says to me, no, you're interested. And he remembers me a year later. He brings me a pamphlet at the to the school. I was skipping school that day. I wasn't in school. I was on the verge of dropping out. He brings me a pamphlet. I take the test to become a police cadet, and for some reason I got accepted to go through the process. I didn't know what was going on. I don't have a high school diploma. By now I drop out of school. And when I get to the interview, I bring all the required documents, and the detective that's interviewing me, she says, where's your high school diploma? And this lady's screaming at me. Like, you ever see rude police officers that just treat you like hell? Like, you're a piece of crap. So this lady is like, she's dogging me. She says, where's your high school diploma? And I said, sorry, ma'am, I don't have one. The pamphlet that was given says graduated or about to graduate. If that's the case, I can go back. If you give me this job, I can go back and try to graduate from high school. She said, nope, that's not how this works. You know what? Try again. She closes my application. And I said, okay, thank you, ma'am. Now, as I'm dismissed and I'm getting ready to walk out of the, I walk out of the area where they were interviewing everybody. I'm almost halfway out of the building. This lady comes running after me. This detective comes running after me. She says, kid, let me talk to you. We need kids like you in this police department. I'm 18 years of age. You know, I don't know nobody. I realized that the cadet program was a very political program at the time. You had to know somebody to get on. And I didn't know anybody. And to me, it's like it was God all day. So she says to me, you know, we need kids like you in this police department. And I said to her, well, no, this is so her next question was, is there anything you can do? I said, well, maybe I can cross the street, because there was a college across the street that was providing GD, giving GD exams. I said, maybe I can check with them to see if they're giving a GD exam. And when I went and I checked, well, so she says, okay, so I'm gonna put your application on hold. You know, let me know. So I went to check, and sure enough, that same week they were giving a GD exam. I barely passed the GD exam. I barely passed it.
Hey, but you passed.
I passed
it. Yeah, but you don't have to say barely, man. You passed it.
Man, I passed it by like 1%.
But that's passing.
It's passing, yeah.
It's passing.
And then I remember that now I'm in the police academy as a police cadet. They single me out, they pull me out of my classroom, they bring me into the captain's office. And the officer that pulls me out, he says, go ahead, tell them where you're from. Go ahead. Tell them that you're not a gang member. Tell them. Go ahead. Tell the captain that you're not a gang member. Tell them where you're raised. And so I tell the captain on the street that I was raised, and the captain's eyes go like this. And he's looking at the other officer like, what the hell? Can anything good come out of this street? And I found out years later that after the academy, that the captain was involved in shootings on that street. So to him, that street was like a condemned street. It was like a really bad neighborhood. But I ended up getting through there. When I graduated, this officer pulled me to the side, and he gave me the best advice that you can give anybody. He said, kid, whatever you do, take out 20 minutes a day to just read. He realized that I was very illiterate. He realized that my education level was very low. So he said, whatever you do, just take time out to read. And since then, like, you can go to my basement and it's full of books. All I do is just read. Like, here, I have a library in my car. I read. And I try to gain as much information, as much knowledge as I can. Because in order for you to feed people, you have to have the source to be able to feed people. You have to become a great thinker. I can't minister to people or talk to people or try to analyze people and diagnose them and say, okay, this is what you're struggling with. This is what we can do, if I don't have that information within me. And then a few years ago, I decided, you know what? I need to start going to school. I need to go to college. Like, I'm buying all these books and I'm not getting no type of educational credits for gaining all this information. I lost my train of thought.
College.
Yeah, so with college, I decided to go to school, but college is so expensive, and I don't have no scholarship or anything. But so I'm in school. I did start college 12 years ago. I had to withdraw for the Sheriff's Academy. I was only able to finish two semesters. And now I went back in 2018, and I started again last year. So I'm wrapping up with my criminal justice. In May, I wrap up with criminal justice, and next year I wrap up my bachelor's in biblical studies. But I always, the same advice I receive, I tell it to everybody. Listen, put away the video games. Feed your brain. Feed your brain. Like, I might not have a sociology degree, but I know people. Mm-hmm. There's some things that I probably don't have the medical term for or the sociological term for, but I can have somebody in front of me and say, hey, listen, this is your issue, man. You suffer from a victim mentality, and we need to do away with that. We need to change that mind from a victim mentality to a victorious mind. I want you to take these steps. And I'm telling you, it's going to work for you. And whoever applies, and because everybody's case is different. Some people, you need to give them a rub in the back. And you need to say, hey, man, you got this. Don't worry. Other people, you need to start talking to them with some tough love and say, hey, listen, stop. Don't call yourself a junkie. Sometimes I tell that to people. Don't call yourself a junkie. Don't call yourself an addict. God didn't create addicts. God didn't create junkies. He created you according to his image and his likeness. So God is not a junkie and he's not an addict. And he wants you to be like him. He wants you to have his identity. So get out of that mindset. You know, don't ever tell me you're a junkie. Stop looking at yourself like that. You need to start seeing yourself how heaven viewed you. Heaven allowed for you to be here on this earth with a particular assignment. Stop wasting time, and you need to fulfill your assignment. Sometimes you got to talk to people like that, you know?
Yeah. Joshua, man, I think we could probably sit here and talk for another hour at least, but we've hit the 1 hour mark, and I want to make sure that we, unfortunately, we have, you know, a time constraint. But man, I'd love to have you back on, because I think our particular population who most listens to this podcast are individuals who are currently incarcerated. We give this out to Paytel, I think, is the Paytel. They put stuff on some of the tablets that individuals who are incarcerated are able to get, and we give it to them for free, and they're able to watch these things for free. So I think they'll be interested to see what a police officer has to say.
You know, well, I have heart for them too. I worked in the jails.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things now, like we have three jail programs that McShin operates, and one of those programs now is still not allowing people to come in because of COVID restrictions. So the only, the connections we've been able to make with them are through Zoom. We've been able to create that link. But one of the things that we use a lot, and I just heard this today, you don't know this, Justin, but Diana was here. Diana, the woman who runs the program at RSW, at one of our jail programs, she says that she uses this podcast all the time for her participants. And I thought that was pretty cool. So I know she'll use this one because I'm going to tell her. But man, any last words, man? I have so many more questions now. I want to bring you on again at some point and talk more. But yeah, I love your message.
No, sorry. whenever you want me to join, let me know in a week in advance and I'll make the time. But again, going back to my view, I love people, and that's there's no other option but to love people. Even your enemies, you gotta love. The Bible says love your enemies.
Yep. Yeah.
So I love people, and anything I can do to help, even if it's a message or if you want to invite me to bring a sermon one day, I'll preach a full-blown sermon.
Go ahead.
No, sorry. But again, you know, I now that I realize this program is also being broadcasted in the prisons, I will, every single prisoner that's even watching me, I will put you in my prayers tonight. And my desire is that you all get to know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, and that you would live a blessed life, and you realize that God brought you here for an assignment on this earth. He has a purpose for you, and he has an assignment for you. And it's time to fulfill that assignment. Don't waste no more time. Time is the one. You can recover a lot of things in recovery and this restoration and recovery, but the one thing you cannot recover is time. So don't waste time.
Amen to that. I love your message. I love your story. I'm glad to know a little bit more about you this day. Thank you, Joshua De La Rosa, for being with us today on Getting the Herd. Justin, man, thank you for being a phenomenal producer, and Art for being the man, the myth over there. And to everybody listening, thank you. We will see you all tomorrow at 3 p.m. with Gigi Langer. She's going to be talking about her book that does, darn it, I Justin's doing the interview tomorrow. It's about worrying. So I'm not even going to worry about it. Justin's going to do a great job. But you talked about books real quick before we go off here. I just want to let you know, man, our boss, Honesty Liller, our chief executive officer at the McShin Foundation, a woman in long-term recovery, an alumnus of the McShin Foundation, she just launched her book on the 22nd on Tuesday. It's already a number one bestseller on Amazon. So if you have a second, check out, if you're listening, if you want to, her book is called Scattered Pink, A Diary of a Woman in Recovery. It is a, it's a great read. Honesty was on the show last Thursday. I'd read the book. We talked about it. It's an honest, it's a raw, it's a resilient story. It's about overcoming some incredible odds, incredible obstacles, and really doing a great job. And I'll tell you, as I'm listening to you tell your story, Joshua, I hope to read your book someday. Just where you were, where you went, and where you're going. There's a story there. And next time you're on, I want to talk about those kids, man, how you work with your kids, your own kids. And congratulations on the fourth one coming. So with that, you're welcome, man. I'm excited for you. It's a good combination, man. With that, everybody have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.
Okay. Take care. Thank you. And God bless you guys.
God bless you too, Joshua. Thank you, buddy.
Honesty Liller. I am the CEO of the McShin Foundation and a woman in long-term recovery. Since May 27, 2007, I have not used drugs or alcohol. Woo-hoo! Thank you so much to the Richmond Times-Dispatch and all of our voters for getting the Herd podcast. Those podcasts are amazing. Not only has it helped thousands upon thousands of people in their recovery, as well as family members, but it has helped me in my personal recovery. I get to listen to them now in my car through Spotify and iHeartRadio. And it's just really, really important for us to be innovative in the addiction field and the recovery community. So when COVID hit, we had to be innovative. You know, we really had to think of like, what can we do to reach people that cannot go to 12-step meetings, smart recovery, faith-based, whatever, that we're shutting down constantly. So we were innovative here at McShin. Let's start podcast. So with Todd, John, Alex, and some other staff, you know, we all just kind of jumped in who can do what. And with Todd's lead and John's lead, the podcasts have been amazing and we're still doing them today. So I want to thank you for all of your votes and all of your energy and all of your support of our mission of healing families and saving lives. Thanks.